This episode of The Ish is sponsored in part by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/The Ish. Again, visit audibletrial.com/The Ish for your free audiobook. Life is complicated. It's layered. Religion, love, politics, there are no easy answers. If you, like me, are drawn to the middle, whether by chance or by choice, this is for you. From Milieu Media Group, welcome to The Ish, a podcast from the liminal spaces of life. I'm Cameron Deason Hammond. This is Season 1, Episode 1, Religious-ish, with author Adrian Shirk. Hey guys, welcome to episode one. Adrian Shirk is the author of And Your Daughter Shall Prophesy, a new book from Counterpoint Press. It's a hybrid memoir that explores American women prophets and spiritual celebrities. Adrian was raised in Oregon, but has since lived in New York and Wyoming. She writes for Catapult, and her essays have also appeared in The Atlantic, among other journals. Her book resonated with me in so many ways, but what really jumped out was a chapter she wrote about religious pioneer Amy Semple McPherson, who is a woman I studied when I was briefly a divinity student. Amy Semple was really America's first megachurch pastor. In the 1920s, she was a celebrity whose friends included Charlie Chaplin and whose Los Angeles church was filled with 15,000 people every Sunday. She was also one of the first religious leaders to suffer lots of scandals. Amy Semple disappeared at one point in her career and very sadly died of an accidental overdose. So she is a figure in American religion that just continues to fascinate. And Adrian's chapter really brought out the things about Amy Semple that have fascinated me. In fact, everything Adrian said in our interview I resonated with. I felt like I found a real kindred spirit in her, and I think you will too. Here's my interview with Adrian Shirk.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi,
it's so good to meet you.
Good to meet you too.
Thank you for being a part of this. So I have been reading your book since I got it, and I was up late into the night just making notes after notes after notes, and I just feel like this book was written for me. I am your target audience.
That's awesome.
I am so happy to see this book in the world. So I just want to say congratulations. So exciting.
Thank you.
So the premise of this show is The Ish. And what that means is talking from the middle sort of liminal spaces of life. And religion is a subject which very rarely is considered to be liminal, right? So especially American religion, it's usually sort of yes or no, us or them. And something that I thought was so fascinating, just to pull out a quote from your book, you say that women have had to find their own ways to divinity outside the prescribed patriarchal orders. And you say, if I have learned anything, it is that the truth shifts. The modes by which to interrogate it must always change and are always changing. And I just think that is so brave to say. And I want to talk to you about kind of why religion. I know that you come from like a non-religious background, or at least a non sort of denominational traditional background. So how did you get interested in women particularly and religion?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it does in a weird way have to do with my very irreligious secular background. It was in some ways those very aspects that, you know, in a way created this negation or this absence that when I, you know, moved away and became an adult, there was all of this just sort of uncharted, unexamined territory having to do with religion. And I think there was an ability that I had, or like a unique positioning I had, to be able to explore religion, because I didn't carry a bunch of baggage because I had grown up in such a sort of, like, you know, secular humanist sort of new age pastiche of non-organized spiritual practices that gave me, or like allowed me to be truly curious and interested in religion without having had like all of these sort of traumatic experiences with it as a kid, which I think a lot of people do. So I was able to assume different kinds of religious practices and identities in this way that like I didn't share with a lot of people. You know, again, kind of finding myself often between people who were either just sort of religious as a matter of course in a kind of unexamined way, or irreligious to the point of finding like my inquiries into religion almost reprehensible. So I was always sort of in this strange liminal space. And so there was that. And I think, again, there was the pastiche quality of the spiritualities of my youth gave me a special access point. And then when I got to college, when I moved to New York, I'm like, this is always the weird part. I don't know, you know, I met someone who was kind of coming from this like punk anarcho art school background, but who was also very interested in religion. Mm-hmm. And then I also fell in love this time with this person. And we happened to be both asking a lot of the same questions, I think, around the time we met. You know, and again, I was like 19 or 20 at the time. And that, you know, moment in my life, that relationship, all of that which I had kind of brought with me from my childhood made possible or kind of exploded open this territory, you know, of like of religious material and inquiry for me. And then that was its own thing for years. And then it really wasn't until later, as I started to kind of like develop all these critiques and, you know, discomforts and whatever that I was encountering in all these different religious spaces, that's when I turned to women. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's when I turned to examining, like, American women making religion as a kind of salve to just the, like, profound shortcomings
right.
I was finding in religious life, in Christian practice, in Christian church making and religion interpreting that I was witnessing, you know, in the early 21st century.
Yeah, it's,
does that answer your question?
It does. It does. And it's so interesting to me because you and I had a very similar sort of background in the kind of irreligious, but I lived in a neighborhood that was Jewish in a town that was sort of split down the middle, half Jewish, half Catholic. And my mom was Catholic, my dad was Jewish. And so neither parent had any interest in religion. They had both sort of decided to move away from it. And of course, I was obsessed from a young age with religion and had very similar experience of like just befuddling everyone that I knew. And so one of the things that I think is so interesting in your book is the way that you weave your memoir, sort of your personal religious and spiritual journeying through the lives of these really iconic American women. And so where you continued with the pastiche, I made a very, very specific, what I now think of as somewhat aggressive decision in my 20s to join a church, to join a Christian church. And make my way through that. And that's a whole other conversation. But what you describe as far as encountering the way that women have to make religion is something I have experienced in my life, in my work life, in my spiritual and my religious life. And I think it's such an underreported conversation. And it's funny because I, during my sort of my most denominationally, you know, aligned moments, I started a Master of Divinity degree and took a course and discovered Amy Semple McPherson, who you have a wonderful chapter on. And I think Amy Semple is such a treasure for the moment we find ourselves in terms of like the megachurch and the role of the megachurch. You describe her as having founded America's first megachurch. And I just kind of wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you see, if any, as the sort of echoes of the present and where we have sort of lost, if we can think of it in that way, where we've sort of lost our way in terms of what she could have established. There was a lot of really wonderful things about her first megachurch that you don't really see anymore. I don't know. I just wonder what you think as you look at kind of, you know, evangelicals and politics and the ongoing conversation about the megachurch. What does it bring up for you with the research you've done on Amy Semple McPherson?
I think the first thing that immediately comes to mind is how her church, her mega church, in, again, the 1920s and 30s, was, like, among the most integrated, mm-hmm. both in terms of class and race, mm-hmm. spaces in California, and probably the West Coast, and probably in terms of, like, the entire country. And so this comes to mind immediately because even now, and I mean, for time in all eternity, and especially now, churches are, like, among the most segregated spaces still mm-hmm. in America today in terms of everything, class, race, sexuality, political, you know, commitments, like. And so what Amy Semple McPherson's megachurch models is something we basically almost never see replicated again. Or if we do, it's extremely seldom, and it's certainly not the MO of megachurches in general now. No matter how large megachurches are, they're always, and they tend to replicate the same kinds of segregation that other church spaces do. But here you have in 1920s, you know, Hollywood, this, like, you know, this church is attracting like 5,000 people per service, right. three times a day, and you have, you know, just this enormous representation of, like, people from all different backgrounds, you know, even just like religious, theological backgrounds, again, and race and class and in terms of where they're coming from in the city. Like, that seems like a huge loss. That seems like something that she actually genuinely modeled. And not even because she was like a social justice warrior, mm-hmm. you know, or identified herself as like participating in, you know, sort of the fight against like the Jim Crow era or like a fight against, you know, a freedom fighter or sort of an anti-racist mm-hmm. activist. Like, she did not claim any of those things. And yet, mm-hmm. you know, she created these structures that provided a lot of ends to those missions. So that's a big thing that comes up, I think. There's also just this like creativity and invention that she models, which isn't to say we don't see creativity and invention happening within churches of all kinds, mega and small. There was just such a scale. There's such the scale of what she was able to do in those churches, putting on plays and casting full orchestras and constantly kind of reinventing how her message was going to be distributed, you know, through radio programming, but like through all kinds of radio programming and radio programming that was constantly changing, stuff designed for children, stuff designed for people who stayed up late, things that were going to be kind of, you know, parables or even sort of news broadcasts. And sort of the role of music, the role of performance, the role of costume, the role of spectacle. I mean, there was, you know, in a lot of ways, something that she modeled, which, again, I think gets left behind, is this practice of, like, constantly reinventing for the public or for the congregation how worship services can look. And while we see today, let's say, in, like, contemporary megachurch, or even just like contemporary non-denominational or Pentecostal church life, you know, we see a lot of like, you know, PowerPoint presentations, lights, sometimes smoke machines. I mean, we see like some of that inheritance, mm-hmm. but it's almost like treating those things kind of like an orthodoxy, like they're a new orthodoxy, like, you know, the megachurch must now always have light shows and smoke machines because that's what Amy Semple McPherson did. But her whole thing was, you know, was about sort of constantly pushing the line and mm-hmm. and constantly kind of like one-upping herself in terms of what was possible within a church space, within a devotional space.
Yeah.
And making use of new media, like making use of media in ways that people had not even thought about using it. You know, that's not something we think about. I mean, there's a lot more to say about her, but thinking just about like her church and sort of her mark on like, on the sort of very problematic mega church history. Those are two things that come to mind.
Yeah. So you talk about, and I loved this part of the book, as I said, but you talk about your own sort of, you know, sitting on the folding chairs in the basement of buildings and attending church plants, sort of non-denominational churches. And you talk also about what you characterize as your own conversion, but you say, I didn't even know whether or not what I'd done was convert. And to most of your friends, you didn't want to talk about it until what you got, you know, were baptized. And I thought that was sort of really interesting. And this tension that I'm interested in this place that I keep coming back to that I admire so much about your particular journey is your willingness to take what you want and leave the rest without condemning it, you know, which I think is a really new space in not only is it new in religious discourse, but it's new in literature. It's new in what people are reading and willing to read and willing to entertain. You know, writing about religion is not like a huge moneymaker. I don't know what your experience has been, but and being willing or finding, you know, an audience and finding publishers and finding editors who are willing to go into those middle spaces, which is what I think you've done really beautifully, you know, with this book. So with that said, I just kind of wonder where you are with your own spiritual life. Do you think of yourself as like a religious person? Do you think of yourself as a spiritual person? I mean, I think I know the answer to that second part, but yeah, well, I mean, where are you in all of this? What does your life, your practice look like?
Yeah, it's a great question. it's complicated, but I think of myself as a religious person. I think of myself as a Christian person. I have a lot of difficulty claiming those words because of just sort of the dubious political connotations mm-hmm. of Christianity or what the sort of like what the rhetorical currency is so frequently of using a phrase like I am Christian or yeah. I am a Christian. And yet I am. Like that's my theology. And then religious is also a word I struggle with because I think, you know, like what does it mean to be religious? What does it mean to be a religious Christian is also very confusing to me. What it means to be like a religious Jew seems like much clearer to me. I'm like, you can't, meaning, which I'm not, but I think like, okay, like when someone is like identifying as a religious Jewish person, they're also claiming like a set of rituals, tasks, observances that they share in common with a lot of people and can be counted upon regardless of what you believe, regardless of like where you're at spiritually or what your relationship with God is like, or even if you believe in God, like yeah. to be a religious Jewish person is to kind of participate in these practices. And I'm like, that's religious life. That's religious life. And I've never understood for myself what religious life or being an observant Christian looks like, because Christianity is so sort of defined by, or, you know, it's sort of like blowing up of orthodoxies of life, of kind of prescribed practices, because it is such like a profoundly, you know, a religion or a theology that so profoundly has to do with sort of the individual in God and the individual in sort of community life. I still balk at the idea of this word religious, because I'm like, what do? I go to church. I go to this amazing church called New Day, which I found as a United Methodist church. I'm not a Methodist. I don't know what I am. I think at different times I thought maybe I was a Presbyterian. I thought maybe I was Reformed, that my theology was Reformed Christianity. I think at times I thought maybe I was sort of like a Catholic lowercase c, but like not attached to the Catholic Church, but like in alignment with Catholic theology, more so than in alignment with like the way that Catholic theology organizes itself, like has all these sort of checks and balances or like public forums in which people can argue about stuff, which the vast majority of American Protestantism lacks. Mm-hmm. No public forums really to robustly have debates. And then there was like a lot of other stuff too. I mean, during that time I was like also occasionally going to sweat lodges and like participating in sort of pagan rituals with my friends and, you know, and kind of drawing from the kinds of things that I had grown up with. So I'm like, which of these things are religious? Which of these things are a theology? Which of these things do I identify with? And by the end of this book, I really felt pretty jaded about the possibility of finding any sort of religious community that made any sense to me. I felt very strongly that like there was no way that I was going to be able to find a community that like didn't like completely compromise, you know, one sort of fundamental belief or another, which is to say that like, as much as I wanted to find like a radical, like feminist boundary crossing church, I also like didn't want to go to like a Unitarian church or like a church that had what felt kind of like really loose, unexamined set of theological beliefs. Like I wanted intense theology and I wanted like intense social justice commitments. Like, and I just couldn't find where those two met. And I just kind of was like, well, I guess the end of this book is that I have this experience and then I'm just drifting in the outer darkness. And right at that time, I ended up finding this church in the Bronx called New Day that is literally these things. And it came because my husband was at a bar one night and he ran into someone who said, you've got to check out this church. And we like looked at the website and we're like, I don't know. It looks like really amazing, but also maybe like a little loose theologically, like, I don't want to go to a social club, like, I want to go to a mystical space, and I want that mystical space to accommodate, like, all this real life stuff, and we got there, and it was amazing, and we've been there ever since, and we, like, became members, which we've never done before at any church, and, like, it's this amazing, like, interclass, interracial, intergenerational church. I've never seen anything like it pulled off before, and it's small, and it meets in a fucking cafeteria, in, you know, in a Catholic girls' school in the Bronx, like, all that is to say, I was able to find or be found by this kind of church that I never thought was possible, that I didn't think possibly existed, and which came at the end of this process, really at a moment when I thought the sort of, I thought the project was over. So I offer New Day because it seems to embody, like, for me, that's what religious looks like to me now, is being a part of this community, which is extremely heterogeneous, both just theologically and in terms of background and radical.
Yeah. Well, that's an amazing sort of epilogue to your book. And, you know, I think so much about all this discussion in culture about the nuns, you know, about millennials in terms of leaving kind of organized religion in droves, and but still creating their own spiritual experiences and lives and expressions. And I think that what you're describing is probably less unusual than we think. You know, I think that for me, my interest and the way that I push through when I struggle with the same things that you talk about, like, you know, does this compromise my feminism? Does this compromise my what I believe about social justice? And those are questions that have to be asked and are examined for me constantly. Yet I still continue to look and to search. And I too call myself a Christian. And I applaud you for saying that. And I think that I understand uniquely how difficult that is, or maybe not uniquely right now, you know, because of the climate that we're in. But you know, I think we have to believe that some of these things are robust enough, you know, if we stay to change, you know, to grow and change, you know, for the better. And I think one of the greatest things about your book is the way that you, you know, cast women as agents of change within the church, within not just the church, but within different religious expressions. And, you know, my experience of sort of having to balance what, you know, don't be too opinionated, you know, don't be, for me, you know, that I, you know, I'm like essentially a New York Jew who moved to the South and became an evangelical in my 20s. Yeah, this is true. It's all true. And had to like learn this whole new culture. But I stayed and I stay because I have seen, you know, the needle move. I have seen the needle move. Not always, you know, but the question of like, will your journey lead you to something that feels authentically true to you and true to your expression of God? Like that's, I mean, that's amazing, you know? That I think that's a real victory. So my question for you is like, what would be your, do you see yourself, I mean, as religious-ish? Do you see yourself as Christian-ish? Like, how does that feel to you? Yes. Like, if you had to pick one?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yes to both. And I think part of it is because of this. Kind of to circle back to something I was saying before, I find those two words to be kind of incomplete or unexamined.
Yeah.
That like when we use a word like Christian or we use a word like religious, there are like all these possible meanings to those words that are not clear to me and that change depending on the sort of context or the person, and that are worth continuing to interrogate and think about. And so I've actually been really, I've always been kind of like weirded out by the word Christian mm-hmm. because I thought like, well, Jesus wouldn't, like Jesus would be horrified if he was like, no, 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 like don't, it's not about me, it's like, it's about, I mean, it is about me, but it's like larger than, it's like, I think of Marx saying, like, I'm not a, like, no, 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 like, I'm not a Marxist, like, don't call yourselves Marxists, like, right. It's not about me, it's not about me, it's about this other thing. And I always think, and so I've been looking at these sort of early things that Christians called themselves, like in the Dark Ages, you know, in the 2 or 3 centuries after Christ's death, and they call themselves like wayfarers, sojourners, travelers. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, those are words.
Yeah.
I like really resonate with.
Yeah.
And those are words that are not in our religious discourse. And those are words that seem to kind of maybe begin to like scratch the surface of like what it feels like to me to be Christian. Like when I say I'm a Christian, I'm like, I'm a wayfarer. When I say I'm a Christian, I'm like, I'm a sojourner. When I say I'm religious, you know, I mean, I'm a traveler. And those words even will change. But so all that is to say is like, I feel like the ish quality for me has to do with a resistance to how unexamined those words feel to me in my own life. And so it's not an ish in terms of, do I believe in God or not? Like, it's not that. I'm like, do I believe in the fundamental truths espoused by like Christian theology? Like, I do. Like, do I believe in the literal story of the gospel? Like, I do, I think. You know, it's like, you know, these are actually things that I believe, and yet I don't think that that guarantees, I'm like, that I'm religious. I don't think that guarantees that I can make sense of that. I don't think that guarantees that, like, I have a fixed identity. And so, you know, what it means is that I'm kind of like, these are questions and beliefs, you know, that I am traveling,
yeah.
that I'm sojourning, that I'm wayfaring with people. Yeah, so the ish is not like an indecision. The ish is not like a confusion. But the ish is more like an openness to the possibility that, like, that it's a process. And that, like, religion is an interrogation that goes on and on and on until you die. That you, like, that the questions sort of should never stop generating. That the interpreting should never stop generating. That the conversation should never stop generating new material. And that, like, and that, like, religion should basically constantly kind of confusing and hard to define until until you die, and then mm-hmm. and then people continue the project. The ish guarantees that there's no end.
Yeah.
In a way, I think that, like, that the words Christian or religious feel like an end to mm-hmm. me.
Yeah. I think you just wrote our mission statement, Adrian. I think you nailed it. Yeah, that's, I couldn't, I, there's nothing, I have nothing to say. That's exactly, yes. So before we go, will you tell people where to find your book and where to find you on social media so they can run out and get this amazing book immediately?
Yes, they can find my book at local booksellers as well as indiebound.com and Amazon and any major purveyors of bookselling. You can find me online at Adrian Shirk on Twitter. You can also find me at adrianshirk.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time and your wisdom and this insight into your life. It's so great. It's so exciting. So thanks, Adrian.
Thank you. Thank okay. you. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure and honor to be included in this, in the first one.
Good. Yeah, you're the first one. You're it, girl.
All right. Okay. Awesome. Nice to meet you,
okay.
Kevin.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye.
Wow. I could not have hoped for a better first interview for The Ish. I am just blown away. I loved hearing from Adrian, not only about these incredible women that she has spent a lot of time researching, but also about her own journey. And I think that, you know, I feel like as women in the religious sphere, we just push on, you know, even when the prevailing wisdom says you can't live in an undecided place. You have to choose. And I so appreciate the way that she articulated that the ish is not for lack of decision making, or the ish is not sort of a wavering of belief necessarily, but more an awareness that life is a process, that especially religious life is a process that is guided by questions that should be renewed again and again and again as we go through this life. And I could not have thought of a better way just to express that. So thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to this first episode. We will be back next week with another guest and another conversation. And I hope that you will join us then. So we'll see you then. We'll see you soon. This episode of The Ish was produced and edited by Luke Bronner. Our artwork was designed by Heather Hale. To see more of her work, visit halehouse.co. Our theme music is from my 2016 album, Words Don't Bleed, produced by Jay Snyder. Check it out on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review The Ish on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And follow us online at The Ish on Twitter and at The Ish Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.